The French. Chapter 8. Lefebvre and Farrell persecuted. Lefebvre intimidated, Briconnet drawing back, Farrell compelled to fly here was a beginning of victory. They already imagined at the Sorbonne that they had mastered the movement. The doctors and monks congratulated each other on their triumphs. But this was not enough. Blood had not flowed. They set to work again, and blood, since it must be so, was ere long to gratify the fanaticism of Rome. The evangelical Christians of Meaux, seeing their leaders dispersed, sought to edify one another. The wool carder, John Leclerc, whom the lessons of the doctors, the reading of the Bible, and some tracts, had instructed in the Christian doctrine, signalized himself by his zeal and facility in expounding Scripture. He was one of those men whom the Spirit of God fills with courage, and soon places at the head of a religious movement. It was not long before the Church of Meaux regarded him as its minister. The idea of a universal priesthood, such a living principle among the first Christians, had been re-established by Luther in the 16th century. But this idea seems then to have existed only in theory in the Lutheran Church, and to have been really acted upon solely among the Reformed Christians. The Lutheran churches, and here they agree with the Anglican Church, perhaps took a middle course between the Romish and the Reformed churches. Among the Lutherans, everything proceeded from the pastor or the priest, and nothing was counted valid in the church that did not flow regularly through its chiefs. But the Reformed churches, while they maintained the divine appointment of the ministry, which some sects deny, approached nearer to the primitive condition of the apostolical communities. From the times of which we are speaking, they recognized and proclaimed that the Christian flocks ought not simply to receive what the pastor gives, that the members of the church, as well as its leaders, possess the key of that treasure whence the latter derive their instruction, for the Bible is in the hands of all, that the graces of God, the spirit of faith, of wisdom, of consolation, of light, are not bestowed on the pastor only, that every man is called upon to employ the gift he has, received for the good of all, and that a certain gift, necessary to the edification of the church, may be refused to a minister, and yet granted to one of his flock. Thus the passive state of the church was then changed into a state of general activity, and in France, especially, this revolution was accomplished. In other countries, the reformers were almost exclusively pastors and doctors, but in France men of learning had from the very beginning pious men of the people for their allies. In that country God selected for his first workmen a doctor of the Sorbonne and a woolcomber. The woolcomber Leclerc began to visit from house to house, confirming the disciples. But not stopping short at these ordinary cares, he would fain have seen the edifice of popery overthrown, and France, from the midst of these ruins, turning with a cry of joy towards the gospel. His unguarded zeal may remind us of that Hottinger at Zurich, and of Karlstadt at Wittenberg. He wrote a proclamation against the Antichrist of Rome, announcing that the Lord was about to destroy it by the breath of his mouth. He then boldly posted his placards on the gates of the cathedral. Presently all was in confusion around that ancient edifice. The faithful were amazed, the priests exasperated. What? A fellow whose employment is woolcombing dares measure himself with the Pope. The Franciscans were outrageous, and demanded that this once at least a terrible example should be made. Leclerc was thrown in prison. His trial was finished in a few days, under the eyes of Briconnet himself, who was now to witness and tolerate all that was done. The carter was condemned to be whipped 3 days successively through the city, and on the third to be branded on the forehead. This sad spectacle soon began. Leclerc was led through the streets with his hands bound, his back bare, and the executioners inflicted on him the blows he had drawn upon himself by rising up against the Bishop of Rome. An immense crowd followed in the track marked by the martyr's blood. Some yelled with rage against the heretic. Others by their silence gave him no unequivocal marks of their tender compassion. One woman encouraged the unhappy man by her looks and words. She was his mother. At last, on the third day, when the blood-stained procession was ended, they halted with Leclerc at the usual place of execution. The hangman prepared the fire, heated the iron that was to stamp its burning mark on the evangelist, and approaching him, branded him on the forehead as a heretic. A shriek was heard, but it did not proceed from the martyr. His mother, a spectator of the dreadful scene, and wrung with anguish, endured a bitter strife. It was the enthusiasm of faith struggling in her heart with maternal love. Faith prevailed at last, and she exclaimed with a voice that made the adversaries tremble, Glory to Jesus Christ and to his witnesses. Thus did that Frenchwoman of the 16th century fulfill the commandment of the Son of God. He that loveth his son more than me is not worthy of me. Such boldness, and at such a moment, merited signal punishment. But this Christian mother had appalled the hearts both of priests and soldiers. All their fury was controlled by a stronger arm than theirs. The crowd, respectfully making way, allowed the martyr's mother slowly to regain her humble dwelling. The monks, and even the town sergeants, gazed on her without moving. Not one of her enemies dared lay hands upon her, said Theodore Beza. After this execution, Leclerc, being set at liberty, retired to Rosy and Brie, a small town about 6 leagues from Meaux, and subsequently to Metz, where we shall meet with him again. The adversaries were triumphant. The Cordeliers, having recaptured the pulpits, propagated their lies and trumpery as usual. But the poor workmen of the city, prevented from hearing the word in regular assemblies, began to meet in secret, says our chronicler, after the manner of the sons of the prophets in the time of Ahab, and of the Christians of the primitive church, and as opportunity offered they assembled at one time in a house, at another in some cave, sometimes also in a vineyard or in a wood. There, he amongst them who was most versed in the holy scriptures exhorted the rest, and this done, they all prayed together with great courage, supporting each other by the hope that the gospel would be revived in France, and that the tyranny of Antichrist would come to an end. There is no power that can arrest the progress of truth. But one victim only was not enough, and if the first against whom the persecution was let loose was a Wolcomber, the second was a gentleman of the court. It was necessary to frighten the nobles as well as the people. Their reverences of the Sorbonne of Paris could not think of being outstripped by the Franciscans of Meaux. Birkin, the most learned of the nobles, had derived fresh courage from the Holy Scriptures, and after having attacked the hornets of the Sorbonne, in certain epigrams, had openly accused them of impiety. Beda and Duchesne, who had not ventured to reply in their usual manner to the witticisms of the king's gentlemen, changed their mind, as soon as they discovered serious convictions latent behind these attacks. Birkin had become a Christian. His ruin was determined on. Beda and Duchesne, having seized some of his translations, found in them matter to burn more heretics than one. He maintains, said they, that it is wrong to invoke the Virgin Mary in place of the Holy Ghost, and to call her the source of all grace. He inveighs against the practice of calling her our hope, our life, and says that these titles belong only to the Son of God. There were other matters besides these. Birkin's study was like a bookseller's shop, whence works of corruption were circulated through the whole kingdom. The commonplaces of Melanchthon, in particular, served by the elegance of their style, to shake the faith of the literary men in France. This pious noble, living only amidst his folios and his tracts, had become, out of Christian charity, translator, corrector, printer, and bookseller. It was essential to check this formidable torrent at its very source. One day, as Birkin was quietly seated at his studies, among his beloved books, his house was suddenly surrounded by the sergeants at arms, who knocked violently at the door. They were the Sorbonne and its agents, who, furnished with authority from the Parliament, were making a domiciliary visit. Beda, the formidable syndic, was at their head, and never did inquisitor perform his duty better. Accompanied by his satellites, he entered Birkin's library, told him his business, ordered a watchful eye to be kept upon him, and began his search. Not a book escaped his piercing glance, and an exact inventory of the whole was drawn up by his orders. Here was a treatise by Melanchthon, there a book by Karlstadt, farther on, a work of Luther's. Here were heretical books translated from Latin into French by Birkin himself. There, others of his own composition. All the works that Beda seized, except two, were filled with Lutheran errors. He left the house, carrying off his booty, and more elated than ever was General Leyden with the spoils of vanquished nations. Birkin saw that a great storm had burst upon him, but his courage did not falter. He despised his enemies too much to fear them. Meanwhile, Beda lost no time. On the 13th of May, 1523, the Parliament issued a decree that all the books seized in Birkin's house should be laid before the Faculty of Theology. The opinion of the Sorbonne was soon pronounced. On the 25th of June it condemned all the works, with the exception of the two already mentioned, to be burnt as heretical, and ordered that Birkin should abjure his errors. The Parliament ratified this decision. The nobleman appeared before this formidable body. He knew that the next step might be to the scaffold, but like Luther at Worms, he remained firm. Vainly did the Parliament order him to retract. Birkin was not one of those who fall away after having been made partakers of the Holy Ghost. Whosoever is begotten of God keepeth himself, and that wicked one toucheth him not. Every fall proves that the previous conversion has been only apparent or partial, but Birkin's conversion was real. He replied with firmness to the court before which he stood. The Parliament, more severe than the Diet of Worms had been, ordered its officers to seize the accused, and take him to the prison of the Conciergerie. This was on the 1st of August 1523. On the 5th the Parliament handed over the heretic to the Bishop of Paris, in order that this prelate might take cognizance of the affair, and that, assisted by the doctors and counselors, he should pronounce sentence on the culprit. He was transferred to the episcopal prison. Thus was Birkin passed from court to court and from one prison to another. Beda, Duchesne, and their cabal had their victim in their grasp. But the court still cherished a grudge against the Sorbonne, and Francis was more powerful than Beda. This transaction excited great indignation among the nobles. Do these monks and priests forget what the sword of a gentleman is worth? Of what is he accused? Said they to Francis I. Of blaming the custom of invoking the Virgin in place of the Holy Ghost? But Erasmus and many others blame it likewise. Is it for such trifles that they imprison a king's officer? This attack is aimed at literature, true religion, the nobility, chivalry, nay the crown itself. The king was glad to have another opportunity of vexing the whole company. He issued letters transferring the cause to the royal council, and on the 8th of August an usher appeared at the bishop's prison with an order from the king to set Birkin at liberty. The question now was whether the monks would give way. Francis I, who had anticipated some resistance, said to the agent commissioned to execute his orders, "If you meet with any resistance, I authorize you to break open the gates." This language was clear. The monks and the Sorbonne submitted to the affront, and Birkin being restored to liberty appeared before the king's council, by which he was acquitted. Thus did Francis I humiliate the church. Birkin imagined that France, under his reign, might emancipate herself from the papacy, and had thoughts of renewing the war. For this purpose he entered into communication with Erasmus, who at once recognized him as a man of worth. But ever timid and temporizing, the philosopher said to him, "Beware of treading on a hornet's nest, and pursue your studies in peace. Above all, do not mix me up with your affair, that would neither serve you nor me." This rebuff did not discourage Birkin. If the mightiest genius of the age draws back, he will put his trust in God who never falters. God's work will be done either with or without the aid of man. Birkin, said Erasmus, had some resemblance to the palm tree. He rose up again, and became proud and towering against those who sought to alarm him. Such were not all who had embraced the evangelical doctrine. Marshal Mazurier had been one of the most zealous preachers. He was accused of teaching very erroneous opinions, and even of having committed certain acts of violence while at Meaux. This Marshal Mazurier, being at Meaux, says a manuscript of that city, which we have already quoted, going to the church of the Reverend Greyfriars, and seeing the image of St. Francis, with the five wounds, outside the convent gate, where that of St. Rock now stands, threw it down and broke it in pieces. Mazurier was apprehended, and sent to the Conciergerie, where he suddenly fell into deep reflection and severe anguish. It was the morality rather than the doctrine of the gospel that had attracted him to the ranks of the reformers, and morality left him without strength. Alarmed at the prospect of the stake, and decidedly of opinion that in France the victory would remain on the side of Rome, he easily persuaded himself that he would enjoy more influence and honor by returning to the papacy. Accordingly, he retracted what he had taught, and caused doctrines the very opposite of those he had previously held to be preached in his parish, and subsequently joining the most fanatical doctors, and particularly the celebrated Ignatius Loyola, he became from that time the most zealous supporter of the papal cause. From the days of the Emperor Julian, apostates, after their infidelity, have always become the most merciless persecutors of the doctrines they had once professed. Mazurier soon found an opportunity of showing his zeal. The youthful James Pavan had also been thrown into prison. Marshall hoped that, by making him fall like himself, he might cover his own shame. The youth, amiability, learning, and uprightness of Pavan created a general interest in his favor, and Nazurier imagined that he would himself be less culpable if he could persuade Master James to follow his example. He visited him in prison, and began his maneuvers by pretending that he had advanced further than Pavan in the knowledge of the truth. "You are mistaken, James," he often repeated to him. "You have not gone to the depths of the sea. You only know the surface of the waters." Nothing was spared, either sophistry, promises, nor threats. The unhappy youth, seduced, agitated, and shaken, sunk at last under these perfidious attacks, and publicly retracted his pretended errors on the morrow of Christmas Day 1524. But from that hour a spirit of dejection and remorse was sent on Pavan by the Almighty. A deep sadness preyed upon him, and he was continually sighing. "Alas!" repeated he. "There is nothing but bitterness for me in life, sad wages of unbelief." Nevertheless, among those who had received the word of God in France, were men of more intrepid spirit than Mazurier and Pavan. About the end of the year 1523, Leclerc had withdrawn to Metz-en-Lorraine, and there, says Theodore Beza, he had followed the example of St. Paul at Corinth, who, while working at his trade as a tent maker, persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. Leclerc, still pursuing his occupation as a wool carder, instructed the people of his own condition, and many of them had been really converted. Thus did this humble artisan lay the foundation of a church which afterwards became celebrated. Leclerc was not the first individual who had endeavored to shed the new light of the gospel over Metz. A scholar, renowned in that age for his skill in the occult sciences, Master Agrippa of Nedesheim, a marvelously learned clerk of small stature, who had spent much time in travel, who spoke every language, and had studied every science, had fixed his residence at Metz, and had even become syndic of the city. Agrippa had procured Luther's works, and communicated them to his friends, and among others to Master John, priest of St. Croix, himself a great clerk, and with whom Master Agrippa was very intimate. Many of the clergy, nobility, and citizens, stirred by the courage Luther had shown at Worms, were gained over to his cause, and already in March 1522, an evangelical placard extolling what Luther had done was posted in large letters on a corner of the Episcopal Palace, and excited much public attention. But when Leclerc arrived, the flames, for an instant overpowered, sprung up with renewed energy. In the council room, in the hall of the chapter, and in the homes of the citizens, the conversation turned perpetually on the Lutheran business. Many great clerks and learned persons were daily questioning, discussing, and debating this matter, and for the most part taking Luther's side, and already preaching and proclaiming that accursed sect. Ere long the evangelical cause received a powerful reinforcement. "About this same time, 1524, says the chronicle, "there came to Metz an Augustine friar named John Chastelain, Chatelain, a man declining in years, and of agreeable manners, a great preacher and very eloquent, a wondrous comforter to the poorer sort, by which means he gained the goodwill of most of the people, not of all, especially of the majority of the priests and great rabbins, against whom the said friar John preached daily, setting forth their vices and their sins, saying that they abused the poor people, by which great animosity was stirred up. John Chatelain, an Augustine monk of Tournai, and doctor of divinity, had been brought to the knowledge of God by his intercourse with the Augustines of Antwerp. The doctrine of Christ, when preached by him attired in chasuble and stole, appeared less extraordinary to the inhabitants of Metz than when it fell from the lips of a poor artisan who laid aside the comb with which he carded his wool to explain a French version of the gospel." Everything was fermenting in Metz during that famous Lent of 1524, when a new character appeared on the stage, a priest, a doctor, an ex-friar, and what had never yet been seen in France or Lorraine, having a wife with him. This was Lambert of Avignon. On Lambert's arrival at Wittenberg, which had been the object of his journey on leaving the convent, he was well received by Luther, and the reformer had hastened to recommend to Spalatin and to the elector this friar, who, "on account of persecution, had chosen poverty and exile. He pleases me in all respects," added Luther. Lambert had begun to lecture on the prophet Hosea at the university, before an auditory who could not conceal their surprise at hearing such things from the mouth of a Gaul. And then, with eyes ever turned towards his native land, he had begun to translate into French and Italian several evangelical pamphlets published by Luther and other doctors. He was not the only Frenchman at Wittenberg. He there met with counts, knights, nobles, and others come from France to see the elector and to converse with Luther, the overseer of the works that were accomplishing in the world. These Frenchmen mutually encouraged each other, and, as is usual with emigrants, exaggerated the state of affairs, imagining that a speedy revolution would lead to the triumph in their own country of the cause which they had so much at heart. "Almost the whole of Gaul is stirring," wrote Lambert to the Elector of Saxony. "Although in France the truth has no master and no leader, its friends are very numerous. One thing alone checked these Frenchmen at Wittenberg, the printing of the pamphlets intended for their countrymen. Would that I could find someone," exclaimed Lambert, "that could print not only in Latin, but in French and even in Italian." This was the posture of affairs when certain strangers appeared. They were from Hamburg. "We come to ask you for some French treatises," said they to Lambert, "for we have someone in Hamburg who will print them carefully." It would appear that there were also a number of French emigrants at Hamburg, and a printer among the rest. Lambert could not restrain his joy, but there was still another difficulty. "And how," said he, "can we convey these books into France from the banks of the Elbe?" "By sea, by the vessels that sail to and fro," replied the Hamburgers. "Every necessary arrangement has been made." Thus the gospel had hardly been restored to the church, before the ocean became an instrument of its dissemination. "The Lord hath made a way in the sea." Yet this could not suffice. Every Frenchman returning into France was to carry a few books with him, although the scaffold might be the reward of his enterprise. Now there is more talking, then there was more action. A young French nobleman, Claude of Toro, who left Wittenberg in May 1523, took with him a great number of evangelical treatises and letters which Lambert had written to many of the most conspicuous men of France and Savoy. On the 13th of July 1523, Lambert, then at the age of 36, determined, in his own words, to flee the paths of impurity as he had always done, entered into the holy bonds of wedlock, 2 years before Luther, and the first of the French monks or priests. When married, he called to mind that he ought not to think how he might please his wife, but how he might please the Lord. Christina, the daughter of a worthy citizen of Herzberg, was ready to be the companion of his sufferings. Lambert told his Wittenberg friends that he intended returning to France. Luther and Melanchthon were terrified at the thought. "It is rather from France to Germany," said Luther, "than from Germany to France that you should go." Lambert, all whose thoughts were in France, paid no attention to the reformer's advice. And yet Luther's sentiments could not fail to make some impression on him. Should he go to Zurich, whither Luther urges him? Or to France or Lorraine, where Farel and, as he believes, Christ himself are calling him? He was in great perplexity. At Zurich he would find peace and safety, in France peril and death. His rest was broken, he could find no repose. He wandered through the streets of Wittenberg with downcast eyes, and his wife could not restore him to serenity. At last he fell on his knees, and called upon the Lord to put an end to his struggle, by making known his will in the casting of lots. He took two slips of paper. On one he wrote France, on the other Switzerland. He closed his eyes and drew. The lot had fallen on France. Again he fell on his knees. "O God," said he, "if thou wilt not close these lips that desire to utter thy praise, deign to make known thy pleasure." Again he tried, and the answer still was France. And some hours after, recollecting, said he, that Gideon, when called to march against the Midianites, had thrice asked for a sign from heaven near the oak of Ophrah, he prayed God a third time, and a third time the lot replied France. From that hour he hesitated no longer, and Luther, who could not put such confidence in the lot, for the sake of peace, ceased urging his objections, and Lambert, in the month of February or March 1524, taking his wife with him, departed for Strasbourg, whence he repaired to Metz. He soon became intimate with Chatelaine, whom he called his Jonathan, and appearing before a meeting commissioned to inquire into his doctrines, "Suffer me to preach in public," said the man of Avignon, "and I will forthwith publish 116 theses explanatory of my doctrine, and which I will defend against all manner of persons." The Chamber of 13, Messrs. The Clerks, and Messeigneurs of Justice, before whom Lambert had been called, were frightened at such a request, and refused permission, and shortly after, the whole troop of Antichrist was in commotion, said Lambert, canons, monks, inquisitors, the bishop's officials, and all their partisans, endeavored to seize and throw him into the dungeon of some cloister. The magistrates protected Lambert, but intimated that he had better leave the city. Lambert obeyed. "I will flee," said he to his master, "but will still confess thy name. Whenever it be thy good pleasure, I will endure death. I am in thy hands. I flee, and yet I flee not. It is the flight which becometh all those who are made perfect." Lambert had not been a fortnight in Metz. He was to learn that God makes known his will by other means than the drawing of lots. It was not for France that this monk from the banks of the Rhone was destined. We shall soon behold him playing an important part in Germany, as reformer of Hesse. He returned to Strasbourg, leaving Chatelaine and Leclerc at Metz. Owing to the zeal of these two men, the light of the gospel spread more and more through the whole city. A very devout woman, named Toussaint, of the middle rank, had a son called Peter, with whom, in the midst of his sports, she would often converse in a serious strain. Everywhere, even in the homes of the townspeople, something extraordinary was expected. One day the child, indulging in the amusements natural to his age, was riding on a stick in his mother's room, when the latter, conversing with her friends on the things of God, said to them with an agitated voice, "Antichrist will soon come with great power, and destroy those who have been converted at the preaching of Elias." These words being frequently repeated attracted the child's attention, and he recollected them long after. Peter Toussaint was no longer a child when the doctor of theology and the woolcomber were preaching the gospel at Metz. His relations and friends, surprised at his youthful genius, hoped to see him one day filling an eminent station in the church. One of his uncles, his father's brother, was dean of Metz. It was the highest dignity in the chapter. The Cardinal John of Lorraine, son of Duke René, who maintained a large establishment, testified much regard for the dean and his nephew. The latter, notwithstanding his youth, had just obtained a prebend, when he began to lend an attentive ear to the gospel. Might not the preaching of Chatelaine and Leclerc be that of Elias? It is true, Antichrist is already arming against it in every quarter. But it matters not. "Let us lift up our heads to the Lord," said he, "for he will come and will not tarry." The evangelical doctrine was making its way into the first families of Metz. The Chevalier d'Esch, a man highly respected, and the dean's intimate friend, had just been converted. The friends of the gospel rejoiced. "The knight, our worthy master," repeated Peter, adding with noble candor, "if, however, we are permitted to have a master upon earth." Thus Metz was about to become a focus of light, when the imprudent zeal of Leclerc suddenly arrested this slow but sure progress, and aroused a storm that threatened utter ruin to the rising church. The common people of Metz continued walking in their old superstitions, and Leclerc's heart was vexed at seeing this great city plunged in idolatry. One of their great festivals was approaching. About a league from the city stood a chapel containing images of the Virgin and of the most celebrated saints of the country, and whither all the inhabitants of Metz were in the habit of making a pilgrimage on a certain day in the year, to worship the images and to obtain the pardon of their sins. The eve of the festival had arrived. Leclerc's pious and courageous soul was violently agitated. "Has not God said, 'Thou shalt not bow down to their gods, but thou shalt utterly overthrow them, and quite break down their images?" Leclerc thought that this command was addressed to him, and without consulting either Chatelaine, Esch, or any of those whom he might have suspected would have dissuaded him, quitted the city in the evening, just as night was coming on, and approached the chapel. There he pondered a while, sitting silently before the statues. He still had it in his power to withdraw. But tomorrow, in a few hours, the whole city that should worship God alone will be kneeling down before these blocks of wood and stone. A struggle ensued in the woolcomber's bosom, like that which we trace in so many Christians of the primitive ages of the church. What matters it to him that what he sees are the images of saints, and not of heathen gods and goddesses? Does not the worship which the people pay to these images belong to God alone? Like Polyucte before the idols in the temple, his heart shudders, his courage revives. Ne perdens plus de temps, le sacrifice est prêt, allons y du vrai Dieu soutenir l'intérêt, allons valer aux pieds si faudrait ridicule, don armon bois pourri si peuple trop crédule, allons en éclair l'aveuglement fatal, allons brise cs de pierre et de metal. Abandonnons nos jours à cet ardeur céleste faisons triompher Dieu, Chuiel dispose du reste. Corneille, Polyucte. Leclerc arose, approached the images, took them down and broke them in pieces, indignantly scattering their fragments before the altar. He doubted not that the Spirit of the Lord had excited him to this action, and Theodore Beza thinks the same. After this, Leclerc returned to Metz, which he entered at daybreak, unnoticed save by a few persons as he was entering the gates. Meanwhile, all were in motion in the ancient city. Bells were ringing, the brotherhoods were assembling, and the whole population of Metz, headed by the canons, priests, and monks, went forth in solemn procession. They recited prayers or sung hymns to the saints they were going to adore. Crosses and banners moved on in due order, and instruments of music or drums responded to the voices of the faithful. At length, after nearly an hour's march, the procession reached the place of pilgrimage. But what was the astonishment of the priest, when advancing, censer in hand, they discovered the images they had come to worship mutilated and covering the earth with their fragments. They recoiled with horror, and announced this sacrilegious act to the crowd. Suddenly the chanting ceased, the instruments were silent, the banners lowered, and the whole multitude was in a state of indescribable agitation. The canons, priests, and monks endeavored to inflame their minds, and excited the people to search for the criminal, and demand his death. But one cry burst from every lip. Death, death to the sacrilegious wretch! They returned to Metz in haste and in disorder. Leclerc was known to all. Many times he had called the images idols. Besides, had he not been seen at daybreak returning from the direction of the chapel? He was seized. He immediately confessed his crime, and conjured the people to worship God alone. But this language still further exasperated the fury of the multitude, who would have dragged him to instant death. When led before his judges, he boldly declared that Jesus Christ, God manifest in the flesh, should alone be adored. He was sentenced to be burnt alive, and taken out to the place of execution. Here a fearful scene awaited him. The cruelty of his persecutors had been contriving all that could render his punishment more horrible. Near the scaffold men were heating pincers that were to serve as the instruments of their rage. Leclerc, firm and calm, heard unmoved the wild yells of the monks and people. They began by cutting off his right hand. Then, taking up the burning pincers, they tore off his nose. After this, they lacerated his arms, and when they had thus mangled them in several places, they concluded by burning his breasts. While his enemies were in this manner wreaking their vengeance on his body, Leclerc's mind was at rest. He recited solemnly and with a loud voice these words of David: "Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. Noses have they, but they smell not. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. Either speak they through their throat. They that make them are like unto them. So is every one that trusteth in them. O Israel, trust thou in the Lord. He is their help and their shield." Psalm 115 verses 4-9. The sight of such fortitude daunted the enemies, and strengthened the faithful. The people, who had before shown so much anger, were astonished and touched with compassion. After these tortures, Leclerc was burnt by a slow fire, in conformity with his sentence. Such was the death of the first martyr of the gospel in France. But the priests of Metz were not satisfied. In vain had they endeavored to shake the constancy of Chatelain. "He is deaf as an adder," said they, "and refuses to hear the truth." He was seized by the creatures of the Cardinal of Lorraine and carried to the castle of Nomini. He was then degraded by the bishop's officers, who stripped him of his priestly vestments and scraped his fingers with a piece of glass, saying, "By this scraping, we deprive thee of the power to sacrifice, consecrate, and bless, which thou receivest by the anointing of hands." Then, throwing over him a layman's dress, they surrendered him to the secular power, which condemned him to be burnt alive. The pile was soon erected, and the minister of Christ consumed by the flames. Lutheranism spread not the less through the whole district of Metz, say the authors of the history of the Gallican Church, who in other respects highly approve of this severity. As soon as this storm began to beat upon the church at Metz, tribulation had entered into Toussaint's family. His uncle, the dean, without taking an active part in the measures directed against Leclerc and Chatelain, shuddered at the thought that his nephew was one of their party. His mother's alarm was greater still. There was not a moment to lose. The liberty and life of all who had lent their ear to the gospel were endangered. The blood that the inquisitors had shed had only increased their thirst. More scaffolds would ere long be raised. Peter Toussaint, the knight Esch, and many others, hastily quitted Metz, and sought refuge at Ball.